Okay, now we start. Good morning to everyone, and welcome to this morning presentation of Safilo first half results 2018, and group business plan. This morning's speakers are the Group CEO, Angelo Trocchia, and the Group CFO, Gerd Graehsler. Gerd will drive us through the presentation of H1 and Q2, while Angelo will drive us through the presentation of the group plan.
Okay. Good morning to everybody. Let me start, as usual, with summarizing the key facts and figures of the first half results before we go into some more detail regarding the different drivers. In terms of net sales, our first half-year performance overall was weak. Clearly, there were some important drivers, while on the other side, the profit and the bottom line were sustained by the cost savings initiatives that have become increasingly visible in our results, which means that on a currency-neutral basis, actually our operating results are above a year ago. As we had anticipated during our last call in May, in the month of April, we had seen a weak start to the sun season, particularly in the core South European markets, Spain, Italy, and France, where sunglass sales continued to be disappointing and decline across the rest of the second quarter as well. And this was not exclusively, but primarily behind the market issue, and we can see this also in the data that we get from those respective countries, that the sunglasses business was down double digits exactly in the core months of the season. First half year was soft for us also in North America, where we suffered a less steep but still continued decline. Here the performance of the core wholesale channel in the period continued to be driven by flattish trends in the independent optician channel, which is roughly 60% of our business there. And indeed a weak performance in department stores and in chains. While the market environment remains in some areas subdued, this comes on top of our specific commercial challenges, in response to which we have appointed a new leader and a management change, so the commercial reorganization under the new leadership has begun and is ongoing. We had also some clear positives in the first half. We reported a strong performance in emerging markets, and a positive business in prescription frames, particularly in Europe, where we grew double digits, excluding the Gucci business. Looking at our multi-segment brand portfolio, first of all, I would like to reconfirm the good start of our new licenses, Moschino, Love Moschino, and Rag & Bone, for the first time in eyewear. In the first half year, in our portfolio, sales from those brands made up more or less half of the Celine sales exited at the end of last year, which is substantially in line with our plans. On the rest of the portfolio, I would spot a positive performance of our own core brands, Polaroid and Carrera, which were up low to mid-single digits. Smith was flattish after a positive second quarter in which it recovered the negative performance reported in Q1. Among our licensed brands, Tommy Hilfiger, Boss, and Kate Spade were positive performers, while on the luxury side, I would say Marc Jacobs was the weakest spot of the period. As said, at the operating level, we made further progress on cost savings in line with our plans, and this helped us to minimize the negative operational leverage coming from the top line. Before getting to the numbers, I would like to highlight again the effects of the foreign currency exchange rates. In the first half year, the devaluation of the US dollar and the majority of the emerging markets' currencies had a negative impact on the top line, a meaningful one, and an impact also at the profit margin level. This mainly reflects the fact that we are quite efficiently naturally hedged on the dollar and have a great deal of revenues and costs in the dollar, while in the other currencies we do not have this kind of natural hedge, of course. To now summarize the key KPIs of the semester, we close first half year with total net sales of 492.2 million euros, down 4.3% at constant exchange rates, while the second quarter was 241.3 million euros, down 19.1% at constant exchange rates. Of course, here the underlying negative performance of the business, which was down high single digits if we adjust for the base of comparison and the pattern of shipments in the wake of the OTC system issues we had last year. The adjusted EBITDA was 25.1 million euros in half one and 12.1 million euros in Q2, down respectively 9.5% and 64.5%. At constant exchange rates, H1 adjusted EBITDA was actually slightly above last year, both in value and in percentage terms. And then finally, in terms of net debt, we stood at 171.1 million euros, which is slightly above the position we recorded in March and compares to 112.7 million that we recorded at the same time of last year. Moving on to our sales performance by geographical area and at constant exchange rates, to recap first on the first half year, sales declined 7.2% in Europe, 7.7% in North America, while the business in Asia and in the rest of the world grew quite substantially. Some additional highlights here. In Europe, excluding the Gucci business, the sunglass business dropped approximately 16%, while prescription frames grew approximately 10%, with Italy, France, and Spain that suffered on the sunglasses side all showing a positive performance on prescription frames. So this highlights again a specific market challenge we had on the sunglasses there. In North America, our core wholesale business is down 6.9%. More of a similar trend of the past quarters. As I said, our independent optician channel showing a reasonable hold, while the business in department stores and chains is down in department store. Clearly, we have been having tougher times for a while, and we are working on repositioning our portfolio more towards premium and contemporary, more to the price points where consumers are now more actively shopping. Sales at our Solstice stores was negative in the semester, 11.8% at constant exchange rates and 4.9% down on a comp store basis, so offsetting in Q2 the low single-digit positive performance that we had in the first quarter. The network consisted of 82 stores in June, having closed 21 in the last 12 months. Sales in Asia-Pacific and the rest of the world benefited from both wider and deeper development of our brand portfolio. Also, particularly our own core brands, Carrera and Polaroid, doing well, in particular in India, the Middle East, and Africa. As an example that we keep mentioning, our business in India, where we have localized the execution of the brand with local endorsers, locally relevant campaigns, we see a very significant growth continuing. Moving on to the second quarter, as we did also in the first quarter, we tried to extrapolate the true underlying performance in the quarter by netting the base period of Q2 2017, where we had a huge boost from the recovered deliveries that were pertaining to Q1 last year. And as you recall, we did exactly the opposite exercise also in the first quarter of this year to add back to the base period those undelivered products following this difficult go-live of the new IT system in the Padua DC last year. So adjusting for this, in the first quarter we quoted a flattish underlying performance, while in the second quarter it was negative high single digits at constant exchange rates, mainly driven by the drivers we discussed on sunglasses. On the positive side, as I said, even adjusting for all of this, our prescription frames business was up low single digits, and we had a core business improvement on Smith. To read out briefly the numbers of the second quarter, North America down 10.9%, Europe down 27.7%, adjusted underlying it's around 13 to 14%, Asia outperforming still at 8%, and sales in the rest of the world down 17.9%, also affected by this phasing. Moving on to our economic performance, and we start as usual from the gross profit margin. In the first half year, our gross profit equaled 254.1 million, dropping 11.5% at current exchange rates and approximately 5% at constant exchange rate. The reported margin dilution of 90 basis points is equivalent to about 40 basis points at constant currencies. Commenting on the latter, so the underlying performance, we had two main and opposite effects. On the one side, a negative geographical mix. Clearly, we had a decline in our most profitable South European and North American markets. We had a big growth in our emerging markets, where we also operate a lot more through distributors, so there's a geographical mix effect. On the other side, let me say that we're very pleased with the progress on the cost savings and the efficiency results in the factories, as well as the reduction of obsolescence, which you may have seen also accompanied by a reduction in inventory. So the cost of goods sold savings in the semester amounted to about 6 million euros that we have been able to bring to the bottom line. In the second quarter, our gross profit was of 126.6 million, down 25.7% at current and 22% at constant exchange rates. Gross margin is down 200 basis points in the quarter, clearly affected by the negative top-line trends. Moving to EBITDA and margin, as usually adjusted by non-recurring costs, we had in this semester approximately 3.5 million euros of non-recurring costs, mainly related to our CEO succession plans as well as reorganization costs in North America. And as you know, with regards to the Kering compensation, we included an income of 19.5 million euros in the first half of 2018, which is included in the adjusted numbers, which is the pro rata portion of the 39 million full year accounting impact this year. The 19.5 this year compares to 21.5 that we had in the last year number. As already said, at constant exchange rates, H1 adjusted EBITDA was slightly up, approximately plus 2% compared to last year. And also the margin, which is reported at 5.1% and same as last year, at constant exchange rates was up 30 basis points. So in the semester, we offset some of this negative operational leverage in Q2 with a total half-year savings in overheads of 13 million euros. And you may recall that we quoted approximately 5 million in Q1. So in Q2, we achieved a further 8 million savings. It's a good number, but it's clearly not enough to recover the strong deleverage that we had from the negative top-line trend. The second quarter adjusted EBITDA stood at 5%. Of course, here we have a dilution of 590 bips, 200 of which is the gross margin, 390 is coming from the SG&A level. Approximately 200 basis points are explained by marketing costs, which are this year more normally faced, while last year, of course, we delivered a lot of products late to the store, so we had a different spending pattern, more biased in the second half year. The remaining 190 basis points, I would say, are spread among all the different lines of selling expenses, which did decrease compared to a year ago, but clearly less than the top line. Regarding the group net loss of 10.4 million euros compared to the loss of 6.6 that we recorded last year, main additional items to explain our bottom line were an increased D&A and a slightly increased also financial charges. The latter moved from 7.3 to 9.7 million euros, primarily driven by higher net interest charges behind the higher net debt, and then we had also some impact from negative exchange rate differences. But broadly speaking, the operating performance then also reflected itself on the net result. Now to the free cash flow. Free cash flow was negative 37.3 million euros in half year one, clearly behind the economic results of the period. An absorption of approximately 20 million euros from net working capital and investments for 13 million euros. Both of those items were lower than last year, so the absorption from net working capital decreased thanks to lower inventories at constant currency. We had a positive flow from inventories of 15 million and a related improvement of 5 days on hand, while on the investing activities, we also chose to, as we said in March to leverage more the investments already made, and so we were able to invest a little bit less in this first semester. Finally, as said, our net debt stood at 171.1 million, not much higher than the position we recorded at the end of March, which was 166 million euros. So the free cash flow absorption in the second quarter quite small, but of course it was 58.4 million higher than what we reported at the end of June 2017. As a consequence of these results, our adjusted financial leverage, which is the ratio between the net debt and the adjusted EBITDA, increased to 3.4 from 2 reported at the end of last year. Moving on to the outlook, so 2018, what do we expect? As we discussed during the Q1 trading update at the beginning of May, for us it was essential to have these two remaining months of the quarter and understand how they would have played out to really get a good gauge, a good read on where we're heading for this year. Based on the second quarter that we closed, which was weaker than our expectations for the reason that we've just explained, we have revised our 2018 expectations. We expect a decline of net sales compared to 2017 in a range of 3% at constant exchange rates, 6% at current exchange rates, and so we're talking about a top line of approximately 970 million euros. This, of course, does imply that we have an improvement in the sales performance in the second half year. We expect an easing of trading conditions in Europe, and we also expect that we will gradually stabilize the performance of North America before then returning to growth, as Angelo will explain later. We expect an adjusted EBITDA margin between 4 and 5% of net sales, so we see the possibility to close somewhat ahead of last year on the bottom line. Our aim is clearly to make the required adjustments to restart the engines of top-line growth, starting from next year, and we will bank now the remaining savings of the previously announced overheads productivity plan. We have achieved 13. We said we will do 15 this year. Clearly, we are well on track, and we want to go a bit beyond already so that we pull forward some of the activities of the strategic plan to start protecting the margins of H2. We expect some further free cash flow absorption in the second half year compared to the level we closed in H1, so net debt could possibly end up slightly higher than what we recorded at the end of June, which at the same time, of course, includes the, let me say, the 30 million euros of compensation, the last of the three payments that we, I remind you, expect to receive within September. I think that's it from me on the 2018 picture. I hand over to Angelo to take us through the 2020.
Okay. So thanks, Gerd, and good morning to everyone, and thanks to be here. I think that already to be here on the 3rd of August, it's a good sign. So indeed, 2018 will be another important year of transition for Safilo. And I think that we have one very clear imperative, which is the one to put the house in order. We need to put the house in order, focus on few things, and focus on very, very clear priorities moving forward. Just two small notes before I go into the discussion of the plan is that, as you read yesterday, we have renewed Fossil license, which is quite an important brand, mainly for U.S., and we have extended Kate Spade. I mean, two note, but not side note. I think it's quite important in the license scenario and the license business in which we operate. Now, going on the strategic plan and trying to share with you where we think we can be at the end of 2020, I want to give you in few slides and in few bullet points, so I think that we are very, very clear where we are going to focus, the key variable and the key driver, which I think are going to make the difference moving forwards. The few things that on which the company is going to concentrate and in which the company is going to put all the efforts. So if we go through the presentation of the group strategy, we will cover four main bullet points. First of all, we want to start by putting the strategy of Safilo and then the company in the context of the industry in which we operate, which I think it's quite an important bit to understand with. Then we will recap what really Safilo stands for, because I really think that Safilo has some competitive edge on one side and there's some weakness on which we're going to work moving forwards and moving in the next years. Then we will go through what I think are the key strategic action, are the key strategic direction on which we are going to work, strategic action which are going to impact both top line and bottom line. And at the end, clearly, we are going to wrap up on what are our financial targets on the strategic plan. So let's start from the market. I think this is, I'm sure that you know, but just to put things in perspective, we operate in a market which today has a value of around 18 billion euro in size, but I think it's even more important, we operate in a market which has been growing for the last 3 years, and we are assuming that it will keep growing also for the year to come. And we have assumed that the growth will be around between 3 and 4%. There are different estimates on the market, but we felt, comparing the different sources, that a range between 3 and 4% moving forward is what is going to happen. So we operate in a market where there is an underlying growth. And why there is this growth there? From one side, we have some demographics. We have a population in the developing market that is aging, and it has higher vision correction needs. And this will provide an important impulse to the market growth. So there is a fundamental there. We have emerging markets where we have growing population, where we have increasing wealth, where we have increasing awareness of health, wellness and brand. So there are some natural structural elements which will push for the growth of the market in that region. And if we look to the consumer, we have the consumer behavior driver, with consumer being increasingly willing to pay for brands that offer distinguished value. And going forward, we will see an increase in the share of millennials in the consumer base. I think that every one of us talks about millennials, but the numbers are there. I mean, the millennials will be a huge push in the growth of this market. And then, clearly, we have some development, if we look to the market with the channel lens. The eyewear industry is still very traditionally fragmented, with a large number of independent opticians, which they will stay there, but by sure that there's going to be growth also from the digital channel, which still it's small, but especially if we look to what is happening in the US, where there is a huge growth of that channel. So yes, small, but with a double digit growth. And in general, this industry is going through a sort of digitalization process, or as everyone is talking now, an omni-channel. And again, especially if you look to North America, or if you look to the north of Europe, you see very, very clear sign. So as a consequence of all what I've said, I think that we can conclude that Safilo operates in a large industry, 18 billion, and it operates in a very attractive market, which is expected to grow at least at around 3 and 4%. But within this industry that I have described before, what Safilo stands for? And I think this chart to understand what Safilo stands for is not to look at us and say how good are we. It's the opposite. I think this chart trying to understand where are we today to really understand what our strengths, but also to work very heavily on our weakness. So within the industry I have described before, Safilo is the second biggest worldwide player. This is a fact. Clearly we are number two at an important distance versus the number one, but we are also number two and a clear distance from number three and number four. And then clearly there is quite a fragmented competition arena. Safilo is traditionally recognized for its product, its design, and the innovation product. And let me say that being new, coming new to this industry, and really looking to Safilo as someone who has had no clue about eyewear before, I really think that this is a competitive advantage of Safilo. The ability to translate, to understand the DNA of the fashion house, to translate this DNA in brands, in a unique product, in product execution. So I really think that this is something which is characterizing Safilo. But Safilo has also a tradition of manufacturing. We have made in Italy manufacturing capacity. We have manufacturing capability. I've been around all our manufacturing sites, and I have to say that still you feel this craftsmanship, this Italian ability to produce. If you go to our Longarone factory, yes, it's nice to say that everyone can produce metal eyewear. I'm not sure that is true when you're asking to produce metal eyewear made in Italy. So I think that our manufacturer, as long as it remains competitive, I think it's a competitive advantage there. And then we have a company with quite a broad portfolio of license. And this ability of managing license, again, I've learned that it goes back to the Safilo history. And I think that it will become more and more important to have this ability to be very, very tight with the fashion house. I think that moving forward, the relationship with the fashion house will be tighter and tighter. And I think here the experience that Safilo has for a long time is going to help us. But we don't have only a licensed brand. We have also our own brands. I'm sure I'm not saying something new to you, but our own brand represents 25% of our portfolio. And I think that Carrera, Polaroid, Smith have a role to play moving forwards. Different maturity, different brand image, different brand equity, but I really think something to build on. And finally, I think that Safilo has a strength in its distribution. We are physically with our people, with our subsidiaries in 40 countries. And in a way or the other, through direct or through indirect distribution, we reach 100,000 point of sales, which is not a small number. But let's allow me to go deeper on two elements. One is the product design and manufacturing, and I like to stress product design and manufacturing because the two dimensions, I think, goes hands in hands. Safilo has 4 design studios, Padova, New York, Portland, and Hong Kong, something which I think is an asset for this company, an asset that I think moving forward we are going to exploit even more compared to what we have been doing in the past. I mean, being in Portland, it's becoming relevant. Portland is the place where Nike is. Nike has 20,000 people there, where Adidas is, where some of the IT companies are going there. So being in Portland means being in a place where you are able to brief and to connect with this unique ecosystem that you have there. Having a design studio in Hong Kong allow us to have the fit, feel, understand what's going on in that part of the world. So I think the combination of product design on one side and manufacturing on the other side, I think is something that we are going to explore. In terms of manufacturing, I think the fact that we have a factory in the U.S., a factory in China, a factory in Ormož, and 4 factories in Italy, clearly, as we will cover later on, I think for me a factory per se doesn't mean anything. A factory needs to have 2 KPI or a very, very clear technological competitive edge, or it has to be competitive from a cost perspective. But having product design and manufacturing footprint so spread around the world, I think can allow us really to cover any kind of needs and any kind of cost position or price position. And this is allowing us to produce 30 million pieces of eyewear, which, again, maybe for me that I'm new, sounds quite a big number of volume produced. So I really think that with this kind of combination, we are really able to tailor product, to design product, to offer product, which can move from the high end of the luxury to the medium end, to the contemporary, or to the mass core. And the other important point is the distribution network that I was saying. I think that one strength that we have and we will keep and we will even build on is the fact that we are present with direct subsidiaries in, as I said, 40 countries. This is quite an important asset on Safilo. We are going to build on that. We are going to reinforce our subsidiaries because I think that is fundamental to have our own people in the market, our own people connected to what is going on. Having our own team in Brazil allows us really to understand what's going there. North America is obvious, but having our own people in 40 countries is a huge asset. Clearly, in some region of the emerging market, it's going to be a combination between direct people and selected distributors. So if we look to the market I was referring to, 18 billion euro market, just if we segmented, which is completely not correct because we have mainly chosen to have a segmentation price-driven, and today you know that the market is becoming fluid, so all this kind of segmentation in the new world doesn't work so much. But as a just fact of simplicity, if we look, it says that we have a market of 18 billion euro. If we forget the 3 billion euro, which is the low end, the private label market, where clearly is not where we think to play, we're still talking about quite a big market. And if we start from the top, you have a fashion luxury, so all the products which goes above 200 euro, which is 3 billion, and then you have the huge market, which is the premium and contemporary area of 10 billion. So clearly here, thanks to our portfolio, thanks to our brand, thanks to our ability to work with the license, fundamentally, we cover all the different segments. So we are really able to move from the mass cool up to the luxury area. So I have to say a compelling portfolio which is allowing us really to play differently price position, but I think even more important, different consumer need, and then eventually we will cover later on that. So, said that, let's really now look to how Safilo is in the context of the market I have described before. And I will focus essentially on three dimensions. If we start from the geographical perspective, approximately 80% of the Safilo business can be found in the developing market and just 20% in the emerging market, which if we look from a market perspective, you see that the market has a different percentage, which means that our developing market, Europe and North America, which are historical, our stronghold, and where we have room of improve because we have been losing there in the last years, we will keep growing there. But clearly, out of this chart comes very clear what is the huge opportunity that Safilo has, which is the one to grow more aggressively in the emerging market. So this is clearly a big, important first opportunity. If we look to from a product category perspective, here again, Safilo is historically a sunglass company. We can see that the market is 2/3 in optical frames and 1/3 in sunglasses, and we are opposite. Historically, Safilo has been a sunglasses company, has been also in terms of the license and fashion have been growing more on the sunglasses. So clearly, from this picture comes what I really think is the second big opportunity for Safilo, which is to really recover and grow aggressively in the prescription frames segment. And if we go to the third dimension, which is the cost, clearly we have been comparing our cost structure with sort of industry benchmark. And here, clearly, out of this benchmark comes that, let me say, we have a way to go in terms of cost. We are definitely 10% more expensive than on if we look to COGS, we are 10% more expensive than our sort of industry benchmark. And also, if we look to the G&A, we are more expensive also there. So clearly, our strategy will be focused on one side on top line, but on the other side, we'll be focusing on the reducing the weight of the COGS and the weight of the overheads on the overall cost structure. So, said that, let's look to the strategic framework that is going to be our framework for the next year to come. Fundamentally, two very clear blocks. One block is that we need to reignite the top line. From a sales perspective, so we need really to reignite the top line, but we will do this with a clear focus on recovering an operating performance. So we need to recover our competitiveness in terms of costs. And how are we going to do that? We're going to do with a culture of agility and speed. This can sound words, are not words. I'm not a guy of the process, so the trick of the game is not going to be process-driven. The trick of the game is not going to be perfect in process. We will win if we will be agile, if we will be lean, and if we will be very fast. I think that the speed is going to be one of the competitive advantages that we need to build if we really like to win in the future. But how and what are we going to do on these three blocks? First of all, as I said before, I really think that being 3 months in this company, I think that the product creation innovation is our strong competitive edge. We have almost 200 people working in translating needs which comes from the market or needs which comes from the fashion houses in unique products. So I think we will keep building on these strengths. But the important change that we need to do is that we need to put consumer and customer really in the heart on what we do. I think that maybe we have got too much distracted in the last years on that, and this is going to be the focus. So building on what is our strengths, but really re-engage fast with our consumer, re-engage fast with our customer, really to take the customer care and the customer relationship at a completely different level compared to what we've been doing in the last years. But the link between these two blocks is going to be all the process of digital. And when we talk about digital, digital doesn't mean only a digital campaign. Digital doesn't mean only digital marketing. Digital doesn't mean only e-commerce. Digital means that we will clearly step by step, because we are not selling dreams, we need to do things. Digital means to digitalize this company, digitalize the sales force, digitalize the fact that we are sitting today on a huge quantity of data that today we are not really able to use. So we are already working with some supplier which is going to work us with the data analytics. I mean, we are sitting on a lot of data on our huge customer base that today really we are not exploiting. So digital is something where we are going to invest in people and we are going to invest in system and money. This is on the top line, but then if we look to the bottom line, as I said before, from a profitability point of view, we will focus in a very clear way in resetting our cost base. We will work on improving our gross margin. We will work in reducing our overall overheads. So, if we open up now, starting first from the top line. Let's focus on the top line first, and then we will focus on the bottom line. So in order to achieve our top line ambitions, what we will do? In terms of consumer segment, we will continue to be a multi-segment player. I think that this is an advantage of Safilo. So we will continue to play in luxury, while we will want to accelerate our growth in premium and contemporary, where we can build on our history and we can build on our own brands and we can build on some strong license that we have in our portfolio. And by the way, that is the biggest market. You saw that it's 10 billion euro. We want to develop our geographies and channel. We will need to catch in fast the growth in the emerging market, but clearly we need to recover what we have lost in the developing market, mainly North America and Western Europe. And as I mentioned before, we will start preying on the e-commerce more aggressively than what we've been doing. We want to grow on the optical business. You saw that we are heavily underweighted there. So clearly, we will approach the optical area, catching a big opportunity, which is there in terms of market share gain. And then finally, just as a remind, you know that the Kering production agreement is ending at the end of 2020, has a reduction in the guaranteed volume effective January 19 of about half. And here, to be conservative, we put ourselves as we will lose all the, we will have the contract as it is with no other upside there. So all this should lead us to a growth rate of about 2% compound in 1920. And if you strip out the impact of the reduction of the Gucci supply contract, we are talking about a 4% growth per annum, which is more or less in line what are our expectations from a market growth. And this growth will give an EBITDA contribution of around 10, 20 million euro. Now, if we look on the other second block, so on the recovery of the profitability, we will focus on savings in cost goods sold area, which we will expect to contribute about 30 million euro. A reduction of obsolete cost, also related to what I said to you before, an extensive use of data analytics, so as better understanding of the portfolio that we are running, this should give us roughly 10 million euro. And then we will streamline our overheads, which should contribute around 30 million. So in 2018, as already Gerd mentioned, we will complete the 30 million euro overhead program that we started some years ago, and we will go for another 30 million euro program for the years to come. In total, this means that we aim to restore an operating profit that is going to be approximately 80, 90 million euro higher than what is today. And you can see that around 70 million out of the 80, 90 million will come from this reduction of cost structure, while 10, 20 will come from growth of top line. And in order to deliver this kind of cost-saving program, we estimate restructuring cost of around 25 million euro over the planned period. We think that this strategy is a realistic strategy in terms of growth rate, is a realistic strategy in terms of action plan, but clearly is a strategy which has to assure a minimum 2% top line, but clearly a big focus on the cost structure. Now, I will go a little bit deeper in a different block of the strategies. So in terms of growing segment, our multi-segment brand portfolio, we have been talking about our licensed brand portfolio, which represents 75% of our business, and we aim to grow this by mid-single digit in the next 2 years. Important to say is that until the end 2020, we don't foresee any change to the licensed portfolio, so we have a clear roadmap ahead of us until then. As I said before, we will play in a multi-segment way, which means that we aim to continue building our traditional strengths in luxury with our key licensed brands, Dior, Jimmy Choo, Givenchy, and Fendi. And we will do this leveraging on our product creation, innovation, and made in Italy capacity I was talking before. Secondly, we see big opportunity to accelerate growth in premium, contemporary, and lifestyle segment. Nearly 60% of Safilo turnover today comes from that segment, which is, by the way, very also profitable. We believe that the strong capabilities that we have in fashion luxury can also be used and leveraged to lift up some of the premium brand, the license that we have in the premium segment, because there is a sort of premiumization of the portfolio where we think that Safilo can play his role. And just if you think I'm thinking to brands like Hugo Boss, Kate Spade, Tommy Hilfiger, and Moschino, clearly there is a strategy of premiumize these brands. And I think that Safilo is the best partner to help them in this process of strategic repositioning. With regards to our brand, core brand, and here I feel sorry that maybe I'm going to repeat something that you have heard, but I think the difference here is that we will do in a more focused way, we will do in less geographies, and we will do with more investments behind that. So I think that Carrera and Polaroid, Carrera has done, I think, a great job in repositioning the brand around what the brand stands for in terms of what the DNA of the brand is there. I think that the same is for Polaroid. So we will build on what has been done, and we will improve the brand equity of this brand, but we will focus on in-store execution. And even more important, I think that both of these brands have a role to play toward the millennials. That angle, I think, to catch this part of the market is going to be a fundamental element in terms of storytelling, in terms of engaging them, in terms of engaging them both digitally and in terms of local activations. And if we talk about Smith, I mean, this is the baby which is always in the middle of the water. I've been in Portland. I've been spending quite some time in understanding this brand. I think also here, by the way, I think it's been the brand which has been performing in the last year. But here we need to, focusing on North America, really try to move or to keep growing on the snow business, where Smith has, by definition, a very, very strong position. I have to say, both in North America, but also in some countries in Europe, but we need to stretch for once Smith into the eyewear, starting from North America. But by sure, Smith is one brand which can really exploit out of what he's doing now. And the last but not least is the e-commerce. I mean, already today, the e-commerce of Smith is growing. And I really think that this is a sort of brand which has this tribe approach, which means that I think the e-commerce is going to be one of the big growth engine of the Smith brand. Second dimension, from a geographical perspective, as I said, big opportunity in the emerging market, and where we think that we will catch this growth trend there with having a grow high single digit for the next 2 years. And due to the fact that we have already penetrated this market, we will build on this, and the approach going forward will be to be less global and more local, or as the more sophisticated people talk today about global. We have some example. I think that Gail was referring to Carrera in India. We have used local influencer. We have used local drivers. Amazing experience. Same experience in Turkey. So we will use, obviously, the global asset, but the global asset will be fine-tuned and stressed and twist to match the local needs. So, yes, global, but with an offer both in product, mainly for the Asian area, but also in terms of advertising, in terms of content, in terms of activation, which will be pushing on local dimension and local twist. We have good example. We will keep investing on this kind of approach. And then clearly in this kind of geographical area, the model will be more and more sort of hybrid model between a direct distribution in some area of these countries, where some other areas are going to be covered by a tight relationship with few partners. Let's move on and let's go to the development market. Here, we expect for the period a low mid-single digit for the next 2 years. And here, the rule of the game is going to be step up dramatically the level of service. I think in North America mainly and in Europe, for many different reasons, but for a sequence of events which have been happening in the last 2 years, I think that we lost a little bit the grip with the customer, the tight relationship with the customer. So really the focus is going to be, for especially for North America and Europe, to step up the customer level and the customer connection, especially with the FRIOs in North America and especially in the south of Europe. The FRIOs, the independent opticians, are quite big, represent more than 60%, so clearly we are going to re-catch that big opportunity there. Clearly, we have announced a change of the management in North America. I'm very happy that Steve Wright has joined us, very experienced guy from, has been working in the optical field for his last 25 years, I think. And with him and with other people that we've got into the company, we are reorganizing our sales team to even improve the grip on this crucial market. And especially in this part of the world, we will push on digitalize our sales force. We will digitalize not only the sales force, but we will push on the B2B, and obviously we will push on the e-commerce. And then the biggest opportunity which we see is all the area of the optician, especially in Europe. There are three countries in the middle of Europe where we are definitely underrepresented in the optical field. So we will focus in this part of the geography on the optical business, and that is going to be the main driver of the growth. If we look from the channel, I think that I already mentioned before, the e-commerce is the opportunity that we really like to tackle. So, as I said before, I mean, the e-commerce is growing, is an opportunity that we cannot, we should catch the growth, we should catch the trend. The trend is there, and we are assuming to double the business in the next 2 years from 3% to 6% sales. How we are going to do this? We're going to do building on our own e-commerce platform. We have an e-commerce website for Smith. We have e-commerce of Solstice. We have just started with the e-commerce site for Polaroid and Carrera. So that is going to be one leg. The second leg, obviously, is to play with the internet player and all with the big guys. My experience from my previous job is that you need to work with this guy. You need to have dedicated people. You need to understand the what they really need. So we started working with JD.com in China. We are doing a lot of work with some of the other big players. And we are going to have dedicated team which are going to run the relationship with these big guys. And then, as I mentioned before, I think that e-commerce for Smith, we have great results in U.S., but I think that we see the opportunity to go outside of North America, and so we will start pushing on e-commerce of Smith also in Europe. Clearly, last but not least, we will continue on the sunglasses. As I said, is the heart, will keep being the heart. But as I mentioned before, the optical business, if you remember the chart, how much we are underweighted in this segment is a big opportunity. So we are assuming in this plan that we will move from 35% to 40% of our sales will be will be coming from this this area of the market. How we will do that? We will broaden the optical part of the portfolio within our full range of brands. We will exploit more the price positioning, because I think there are, if we look especially to Europe, there are some area of price position that today we are not tackling, and clearly I think we have the portfolio, or where we will not have, we will develop a portfolio able to tackle that, that part of the market. Obviously, to win in optical, you need to step up the after-sales service, and this is what we are going to do, both in Padova and both in the country where we are going to focus. So overall, the company, also in terms of people, is going to refocus around this big big opportunity from a market perspective. Then, step by step, we will try to catch it as much as we can. But I think I've talked enough about top line. Let's move now to the second area, which is where and how we are going to recover our profitability. So, first of all, we want to improve our cost of COGS. Today, we are around 50% of gross margin, and the cost of goods represent a pool of roughly half billion euro. So this amount of money is split around three areas. There is a big spending area in the procurement, in sourcing finished product and raw material and components. There is a spending pool which is related to our manufacturing facilities, and there is the last spending pool which is in distribution and logistics. In this area, we want to save 30 million euro out of this 500 million euro, which is the overall bill. So on one side, we want to further improve what we have already have a good track in doing, which is working on procurement, taking out costs from our sourced product and from sourced material. And on this area, we will keep working on reducing our base of partner, our base of supplier, but having a more tight relationship with them. And on the other side, we will keep working more and more in redesigning our product, really understanding what is needed for the consumer and what is the right design to cost. The second area is manufacturing. As I said, for me, my position on manufacturing is very clear. The manufacturer needs to show a competitive edge or need to show a cost effectiveness. And these are going to be the two criteria. So we will work, we will invest to improve the efficiency of our plan. We will improve to have the best possible factory. We will work to have the to reduce the gap that you saw that we have compared to our competitors in terms of COGS. And there are projects that we are going to start already in 19, which is, if we look to our factory, there is a disproportion between how the factory are designed. So some of our factory are going to be redesigned to optimize the flow within the factory and how we run the different in factories in Italy. Just give you a new example. We have four factories at the distance of 200 kilometers, which for me is nothing. That is fundamentally, it can be managed like one factory. So this is something that is going to have an impact on the overall indirect structure. And last but not least, clearly we will keep working on our distribution network, keep optimizing the number of distribution centers, but I think more than the number of distribution centers, I think what is going to be important is that we are going to optimize the flow of our material, both raw material, packaging material, and finished product between our factories and our depot. All this should deliver 30 million. The second area where we found some benefits on gross margin is the reduction of the obsolescence cost. I think that this is an area which people keep explaining to me that is part of the industry, but I really think that our obsolete cost, it's, I think that is not acceptable to have also, I think it's not acceptable to have such a high level of obsolete. How we are going to work on this? First of all, reducing the lead time in our factory, which means that we will try to be as close as possible to when the volumes are needed. So we will build up front less stock. We will have a supply chain more reliable in the sense that all our factories now have KPI, which on the weekly basis, on the daily basis, and then consolidated on the weekly basis, we are going to measure how consistent is the delivery of the factory compared to what was the plan there. And the last but not least is all the area of the forecast accuracy, where clearly this is a business which I understand is very complex in terms of number SKU, in terms of number of collection, but I think that we are redesigning the way in which we forecast by SKU to be very, very tight, or at least to be tighter on the forecast accuracy. So all this action will lead us to a reduction of 10 million euro from the obsolete cost. And then looking to the overheads, also here we are targeting a 30 million euro saving. I have to say that here, in the past, this company has shown the ability to deliver, because I think in the last 3-4 years, 30 million have been already delivered on the overheads. And we will start another program which is going to push us to deliver another 30 million. These 30 million overheads, I'd like to be very clear, start from one point. We will not touch the sales people. We will not touch our resources, which are the face to the customer. The contrary, we will increase the sales people. We will increase the grip on the market. So that is not where we're going to look for the saving. We are going to look at the saving in the general expense. We have started already a project. I think that everyone knows the approach. I mean, the ZBB or zero-based budget, we have already started now. We are really challenging any kind of cost in this company. So that is going to be the first action. Second action is that we are redesigning and simplifying our organization. At the end, we are a 1 billion company. We don't need to have such a complex process-driven company. We're going to be a more people-empowered and accountable country. So we are going to simplify the organization and the way in which we work. And finally, thanks to the IT, some of the activity that today are spread all over the place will be centralized and make in a easy and fast way. Clearly, this is a big area, but I think that Safilo has shown the ability to do. But I think the more important effect here is, on top of the 30 million, is to have a company which is leaner, is simpler, and is more agile. I really go back to the concept. I really think that if you like to win in the license industry, you need to be fast. We need to be really fast in answering, in giving the right answer to the fashion house. So for me, the results of this operation is not only the 30 million saving, but is also to have a company which is lighter and leaner. So just to summarize, because I think that you are tired to hear me. So what are the three big areas? So in terms of sales growth, we expect to reach just over 1 billion euro of sales in 2020, which is approximately a 2% growth rate versus 2018, which, as we strip out the Gucci business effect, means a growth of approximately 4%. Secondly, we expect, thanks to all what I've said before, to reach an EBITDA of between 8-10% of the net sales by 2020. And I think that this is going to be a minimum. The 8% is going to be the minimum threshold for us, and a lot of efforts is going to be put to really come to that point. And finally, we have the expectation that through the growth of sales, the improvement of the economic performance, as well the lower absorption from working capital, we will start having a positive free cash flow from 2019. So the sum of all this, we believe, will restore the minimum level of profitability that this company needs to deliver, and will improve the cash flow and also restore a reasonable level of net debt to EBITDA around 1.5 times. So, thanks very much for that. But before concluding on the strategic plan, I will ask Geert to comment on, I'm sure, the question that is in the mind of every one of you, which is the refinancing. Up to you, Geert.
Okay. Thank you, Angelo. So when we talk about the refinancing, we're talking about the current financing framework the company has of 300 million euros. It's split into 150 of a revolving credit facility expiring at the end of November and 150 of an equity-linked bond, which is due on the 22nd of May 2019. Let me add that, as you have also seen in our communication and in the numbers, that on the revolving credit facility specifically, we have exceeded the level of leverage ratio that is specified in the covenant. So to probably preempt a question, what does this mean? Let me say that what this triggers is a remediation period of 90 days, so we will retest again the covenant with the third quarter results, which is an activity that then, of course, we run through the month of November, which actually then coincides almost with the natural expiration of the facility. So at the end of the day, no matter this, the topic for the company clearly is that it needs to refinance its structure. And let me give you an update of where we are on that. So first of all, today marks an important starting point because we are outlining the business plan of the company. We are telling you and the market about where the company wants to go, how do we want to restore profitability, cash flows, reignite sales growth. And I think this marks also an important parting shot, if you wish, for the refinancing exercise, as we clearly need to build this on the turnaround of Safilo. So the second thing is that we have clearly been working very actively in the past months. What was very important to us while we were working on these business plans and preparing that was to get, let me call it, a bit of breathing space. So we negotiated with our banks an extension of this revolving credit facility, which originally had been due at the end of May until the end of November. So this gave us this important breathing space to prepare. Now, where are we today? Let me say that as a management, as a company, we are evaluating all the options of a refinancing. We're looking at the options on the debt side. We're looking at the options on the equity side. And at the end of the day, with the aim to find the right solution, to find the right mix or combination of solutions under the vectors of time. So we want something that clearly is within the time frames of the maturities ahead of us, within the vector of cost. So we want a financing solution that has a reasonable cost for the company and allows us to focus on the execution of our business plan, and through the vector of probability of success. So we clearly want to do something that has a chance to succeed. As part of this process, we are in active discussions with key financial institutions, of course. We are also in discussions, as we have said, with our reference shareholder, HAL, to see if and how they can support this refinancing, again, to make sure the time, the cost, and the success probabilities are maximized. I will also tell you that today no decision has been reached yet. The competent bodies, let me say, of both companies have not, decided on anything, otherwise we would be communicating it. But we are quite advanced in the work, and let me say that we are confident that we will conclude this successfully within the maturity timelines that are ahead of us. I think with this...
Yes.
Thank you, Gerd. And this concludes our presentation. And of course, we are ready now to take your question from the room first, and then I will obviously also allow the people following on the call and through the webcast. Apologies for the line that we know is has not been good. I hope you have been, in any case, able to follow the majority of the speech. So please, let's go ahead with the questions.
Domenico Ghilotti from Equita. First question is on the financing need implied by your business plan. So the peak financing, what is the amount that you are looking for in order to execute with the right buffer and the plan? The second is on the manufacturing footprint, in the sense that you were mentioning that you are now both using, say, third-party suppliers and your own manufacturing footprint. How are you evolving this strategy, looking at your presentation, your cost savings?
Okay, I take the first point. So today, our financing frame is 300 million euros. So this, I would say, is, let me say, the minimum that we would aim to refinance. Clearly, doing an exercise like this one gives an opportunity to make sure that we do it once and then we do it to a sufficient degree that we need to execute the plan. So I would see the 300 million as a minimum level, possibly targeting slightly above that in order that we have the flexibility for the coming years.
The second question, I think, as I said, I think the two main KPIs for the manufacturing strategy for me is any site needs to have a competitive technological competitive advantage and or needs to have a cost advantage. Said that, I think that one of our strengths is that our portfolio really covers, as you saw there, the different price position from 80 euro up to 400 euro. So the made in Italy will be a focus area, but clear the made in Italy per se is needed from a part of our portfolio. There is a big part of our portfolio that is not asking for the made in Italy. So in that case, we can explode as much as we can our overall portfolio. Specific on the made in Italy, I think that some of our factory have, especially metal made in Italy, I think is a big, important competitive edge on some of our Italian factories, so we will explode as much as we can that competitive edge. But it's going to be a mixture driven by the two KPIs that I said and by the needs from the fashion house. I mean, clearly there is this premiumization process which is going on some brands. That premiumization process will help the factory in Italy because clearly to premiumize made in Italy is needed. But the decision is going to be based on competitive advantage and cost. And we can really cover any kind of need according to the product, according to the fashion house, and according to the price position that the fashion house is going to ask us.
Well, while maybe we wait for an additional question for the room, I take a question from the webcast, which is a bit related to all the refinancing topic, but specifically on the breach of the leverage on the revolving credit facility. How do we intend to address that? And should we expect the cost of capital to increase for Safilo in the near term?
Well, as I said before, clearly, how do we intend to address that? At the end of the day, we intend to address it with the refinancing exercise that we want to complete within the maturity timelines and the remediation of the covenant and the maturity of the current facility are coinciding relatively closely. So the solution at the end of the day is to execute this refinancing. I think that in terms of cost of capital, clearly at the moment, and you've seen it in the financial results of the company in the semester, we've had an increase in the cost of interest because we've had a higher level of debt. At the end of the day, the cost of capital for Safilo will depend on what is, or the cash cost of capital for the company will depend on the mix of solution, the combination of solutions that we will define. So that's something that will come out of the exercise that will run in the coming few months.
I have another question on, well, first of all, on the CapEx. I saw that they are going down in the first semester, but I'm trying to understand if in the plan you think that you need less, let's say, investments compared to the past. Second question on the level of service. There is a clear effort in improving the level of service. Don't you think that the combination of Luxottica and Essilor is raising the bar further? So really, you are, let's say, competing with in an industry that is becoming more challenging in terms of service level agreements. And last question is on the online. If I understand properly, you are on this side, you are competing with your clients because you are so establishing so your own e-commerce platform for Carrera, for Polaroid. So how does it fit with your idea positioning of pure wholesaler?
Okay, I start with the first one. So in terms of CapEx, in 2018, I'd expect us to spend approximately a ballpark of 30 million euros. Then in 2019 and 20, we have a program of 80, so roughly speaking 40 per year. I think you will see us invest about 50 of the 80 into the product supply network and approximately 15 into the IT rollout. So we'll have a slightly higher level in the next couple of years. We're going to be completing our IT system rollout in the next couple of years. This year, we're taking a bit more easier approach after last year. So we're doing a more phased out rollout schedule to be sure we have a real good risk management in place so that what happened last year doesn't happen again in the next 2 years, and therefore you'll see a bit of a ramp up of IT in the next couple of years.
Okay, I'll try and answer to the other two questions from your side. The level of service, I don't think honestly that Luxottica, Essilor, I'm not sure that they are increasing the level of service. This is something that if you talk with the customer, I'm not sure this is the case. I see opposite. I think that we need to improve our level of service because I think that we have been lefting too much space to the others. But I think that the new reality in the industry can be for us a big advantage. So I see opposite than what you see there. And when I go to customer service, I really think that especially if we like to grow on optical, but in some area of the, especially North America and Europe, I really think that this is, I've been talking with a lot of customers in North America, I've been talking with a lot of customers in Europe in the last 3 months, and there is really an ask for them to, for us to improve the level of service, because then they can really get our product, because in some area, in some category, the quality of our product is by sure strongly recognized. So once we will build on our improved level of service, that becomes a big spin-off to really get back in the heart of our customer. Second question about e-commerce. I don't think we will get in a competition. I think that the world is so big. I think it's a reality. E-commerce is the reality. We can like or not, it's there. In U.S., it's growing double digit every week. I've been in U.S. meeting some of these guys. They keep growing 15% months after month. So I don't think that we will represent the competition for the retailer. But on the other side, I think that the e-commerce for me is also a way to connect directly with the consumer, because the consumer today is not true anymore that e-commerce goes against physical shop. The reality is that the consumer today buys on e-commerce and goes to the physical shop. There is a combination between the two way of buying. So I don't think it's a competition, also because if we will triple, we will be really, really nothing. You know, we will be una goccia in this big ocean. So I don't think that is the competition. I think that the customers today are more afraid about other change in the industry. So I think that there are some other players which by far are more aggressive in terms of potential competition.
I think if I can build a bit maybe on the first point regarding customer service, because one of the strategies that I think is different from the past strategy. If you look 5 years ago, Safilo was an extremely decentralized company to a degree that the headquarter was more or less a holding company. In the last 3-4 years, I think we tried to centralize a lot of activities and we became a much more centrally run company. And one of the things we centralized, for example, here in Europe is the customer service. I think what Angelo was illustrating also throughout the presentation is we aim to correct that balance a little bit and become, again, a bit more decentralized, a bit more relevant, accountable, empowered at the local level. And with the opticians, this is a relationship business. And I think for the optician, it's a very different thing if he's in the north of Portugal and he calls a Portuguese guy in Portugal and has a conversation rather than he calls a call center that is currently in Padova. So I think you'll see us shift a bit more back to empowering the local organizations, and customer service will benefit from that.
Yes, Marco Baccaglia from Kepler. Two questions. First is a clarification. 1.5 times debt to EBITDA 2020 is no equity injection assumption. Second question is about your production setup. You showed that you are only doing 40% of your products directly and the other ones are outsourced. This has been always a big question mark about Safilo, so one of the big players who is leaving the margin of production of 60% of the products outside. So I've not seen a specific assumption on that, but I would like to understand if you are not able to do it, if the investment is too high, what is your spare capacity, how do you see this balance going forward, also looking at your cost-cutting assumptions?
No, I don't think the issue is how much we produce inside and how much we produce outside. I don't think that is not the criteria, and by sure that is not going to be the driver of the choice. I think the point is, according to which part of our portfolio is going to grow more, we will decide what is the best option or to buy or to make. That is simple. So there is not a thing we should move from 40-60 to 50-50. For me, that is not a criteria, honestly speaking. I think that we have a strong procurement base and we have a strong relationship with few limited suppliers outside. And I think that we keep building on that relationship, where, in the meantime, if some brands, which in some case is the case, they are asking for having more made in Italy, more product with craftsmanship, like, I don't know, okay, I don't like to mention some specific license, that in that case, I think that we will work to make our factory in Italy more efficient than today, so that it will be more convenient for the fashion house to have the production in Italy. But the criteria is not to have a right balance. I don't think that is the model. That is not my criteria. My criteria is if it is a fashion house which is asking to have premium made in Italy metal, yes, we go to Longarone and we will make Longarone the best possible plan for metal made in Italy. That is the point. But if someone is asking, I like to have a price position which is allowing me to have an injector model, the competitive edge we will put in is the product design, the product development, but then we will produce where is best to produce it. So I think it's case by case, technology by technology, and product range by product range. For me, yeah, that's it.
For those on the phone, to the first question, so the net leverage number does not include an equity injection assumption.
Yes, we take the question from Domenico, and then I ask the operator to open the line for the conference caller.
No, just a follow-up on
Marco's previous question. It's not a matter of Italy compared to, say, the rest of the world, but so you have a plant in China. It was not clear if you were trying to, say, get not just components, but, let's say, the complete pair out of China as a competitive, let's say, alternative to a third-party supplier in emerging market. So how do you see, the strategic positioning of this plant?
In China is one of the plants where we are going to invest to make it more efficient. So obviously the aim of the Chinese plant, but is the aim as any plant. It has to be competitive. So there is already an action plan, very, very detailed, that we are going to implement in Q1 to make Suzhou more efficient than it was today. So the aim is that Suzhou has, or our Chinese factory, needs to get as efficient as the other Chinese plant. That is the aim. And as soon as we have the same level of efficiency, then we will ask ourselves, okay, there are production that currently are made outside. Should we get it? Or instead of only components, should we produce the final product? But for me, the criteria is the factory needs to be competitive versus the external benchmark.
I think, building on that, if I look 4 years back, our Chinese factory was basically only able to make components for finishing in Italy because it wasn't efficient enough to compete with suppliers on any finished product. If I look today, the Chinese factory makes north of 2 million pieces of finished product because through the improvement in efficiencies, through the improvement in manufacturing costs, we are now able to make brands in the upper contemporary premium lifestyle segment there as finished products. We are not yet able to make the mass cool segment in the Chinese factory. So as Angelo was saying, as we continue improving efficiency, we will be more and more able to do it, but we don't do it as an end in itself. Our objective is to make the plant competitive. If the plant can compete with the suppliers, then they deserve the volume, and then we will put it in there.
Okay, I ask the operator to open the conference call line as we have two people queuing for questions. So Cedric Rossi from Bryan Garnier first.
Your line is open, Cedric.
Yes, good morning, everyone. I've got three questions, please. The first one is regarding the eyewear industry. So I understood that you were expecting a 3 to 4% growth in the coming years, but could you share with us the different what kind of level of growth rate do you expect between the different price points, so fashion, luxury, premium, contemporary, and mass cool? The second question comes to the your EBITDA margin improvement. So I understood that you did not take into account a scenario of losing licenses, but in the meantime, I know that you face the potential risk of losing Dior in 2020. So do you actively look for additional licenses in order to compensate any potential loss in the future, so in order to keep a safety margin? And the third question is regarding your e-commerce strategy. So I noted that you expect 6% of sales by 2020. But could you give us the split between your own platforms and the marketplaces? Thank you.
Okay, I can start on the first question. So the 3 to 4% industry growth, first of all, it's a combination of estimates. I mean, we have our own estimates. We have some data in some markets from consumer panel. And then we use also sources like Euromonitor. And you get quite a broad range. I mean, there are some sources that are saying the market could grow as much as 5, 6%. There are others that are saying 2, 3%. We feel the 3, 4% range is approximately the right one. It's consistent with the past. In terms of the growth by segment, let me say that it is based on our data. It is quite similar. There is probably a notch more at the top end and a notch more at the mass cool end of the market, but we're talking maybe a 3% versus a 4% growth rate. So it's reasonably consistent across the segments. In terms of your second question,
I go for that. Yeah, I answered. So the second question is on Dior. I mean, first of all, this plan is, as clearly stated, is 2020. So to be on the safe side, this plan which has been presented doesn't take into account new license. Obviously, we live in the license industries, so obviously we are working with to have potential license. Have not been taken into account on this plan on purpose. First point. So about yours. So till 2020, there are no changes. Obviously, I mean, our relationship with the Dior is very good. We are working very well. The team, the reciprocal team are happy. But said that, obviously, we are preparing for different scenario. And for me, the best way that we have to prepare for the different potential scenario is to get fit in terms of manufacturing. So to have our manufacturing facilities even more efficient than when they are today, especially Longarone, has to become even more our jewel. Second, we are preparing as overall company to get, I said, the brief to my team is we have 2 years to get like an athlete, fit, in shape, with the right muscles. And then we will see what will happen after the 2020. For me, the priority now is to keep working as we are working with Dior. We are working very well, but to prepare ourselves in terms of efficiency in the factory, in terms of having a leaner and more prepared company. In terms of the last question on the e-commerce, as I said, is a combination about our own platform and the marketplace. Almost in our plan, we are assuming 50-50%. So the same rate of growth will come from our own website, and 50% will come from working with external, with a marketplace player.
Okay, the next question from the call is from Alberto Cecchinato Fidentiis. If you can open the line, operator, thank you.
Hello, good morning, everybody. Apologies if you have to repeat yourself, but the line is very disturbed. I got two questions, please. The first one regards your net debt EBITDA target of 1.5 times. Given that you have an 80 million capex program to be executed in 2 years, I was wondering, I didn't actually hear the answer to Marco's question about if you including new equity in your target or not. And if not, if you can please walk us through the components on how do you get from the net debt position you expect for this year to the 2020 implied net debt position, which should be something in the ballpark of 130, 150 million, if I'm correct. And the second question is about your excess capacity in Italy. If you have any, how much do you estimate to have based on your business plan, and how do you plan to address it? Thank you.
Okay, I start with the first question. So sorry if the line is not so great, but basically. The answer was that we do not assume in the net debt EBITDA ratio of 1.5 any equity injection. So it's more of a ceteris paribus on the current capital structure. So then, of course, how do we get to a 1.5 from a ratio of 3.4, if you wish, that we are at the end of the semester? I mean, one important thing is clearly that we expect to grow our EBITDA, we expect to grow our earnings, which will generate a positive flow from operations. Of course, this positive flow from operations in 2019 and 20 has to be really from operations, i.e. there is not going to be another 30 million coming from Kering, so it will really be an improvement of flows from operations. Secondly, I think we expect on top a positive flow from the net working capital, because one of the things that we explained also in the presentation is our attack on inventory is not only a means to reduce obsolescence costs, we also aim to improve the inventory days on hand by 50 days. So this is a quite significant freeing up of cash that is bound in inventory and that will contribute positively to working capital in the next couple of months. And then, of course, we need to, from the additional cash that we generate here, fund our 80 million of CapEx investment program. We have to fund also the 25 million of restructuring costs that we expect in the biennium of the period. And as we said, we basically then expect a free cash flow positive year in 2019 and 2020, which then can, of course, be used to reduce the level of debt and with the higher level of earnings to improve the leverage.
With reference to your second question, which is about the capacity of the Italian plan, yes, we have an excess of capacity taking into account the assumption that we are taking in the plan. And clearly this has an impact on our Italian factory as an impact on our level of employment in Italy. But allow me to say that we will tackle first this topic in detail with the union and with the competent parties, and then clearly once we will start this journey and this work with them, we will be more clear. I'm just meeting the union at 3 o'clock, so I feel that it's more fair to clearly start discussing with them. But yes, we have an excess capacity in the Italian faction.
We have an additional question from the webcast, confirmation on how much the revolving credit facility is drawn at the end of the semester, Gerd.
At the end of the semester, it was drawn for 135 million euros.
Okay, I mean, I don't think there are additional questions from the room, the conference call, and the webcast. No, sorry, okay. Gianluca.
Hi, good morning. Gianluca Pacini, Banca Intesa. A question on the cost saving on your overhead side. You are calling for 30 million further reduction. It took to you more or less 4 years for implementing the previous plan. Is not going to be a little bit optimistic to deliver such amount of money in just 2 years? And the second question, if you could give us some information about your own brand. What's the strategy about Carrera and Polaroid? Because we missed a little about to discuss that. Thank you.
I think on the first question, the previous overhead program that we announced in 2016, and we had a 3-year framework, we actually managed to complete it within 2018, meaning that we generated roughly 13 million of savings in 2017, and we'll be doing 15 million in 2018. So at the end of the day, we were able to do 30 million within 2 years, and we're going to repeat that. We're well on the way to get the first important set of initiatives going. I'd expect us to have, you know, a big chunk of it already in 2019. So I think we are pretty confident that we can do it within 2020.
Yeah, okay. The second question is on Polaroid and Carrera and Smith. I mean, what is the strategy? The strategy is that I think that the three brands, I think, will be treated differently. I think that Polaroid and Carrera, I think they have this characteristic, which I think is working today. All, if you look to all the brands which have been successful, are brands which have a strong DNA and a strong tradition. So I think that we are going to stress and build even more behind the Carrera DNA. I think the positioning which has been found last year is the right one. So it's getting out a little bit back, but not back where it was really 10 years ago, not so out of what Carrera is. So we will build on the Carrera DNA, which is the position that you see today. I think also the new campaign, that is going to be the position of Carrera. But we will stress more the DNA of Carrera. DNA is a brand which starts from a strong characterize brand. This is what Carrera stands for, and this is where we are going to invest. You know that we have also done the agreement for the Formula One, so that area, that kind of platform is going to be the platform on which we are going to work on Carrera in terms of branding. The other difference is that we are going to invest in few countries. We are doing a very clear selection on few markets where we see that this Carrera, this new Carrera position is working. So we are going to heavily invest in these countries, where on the other side, in some of the emerging countries like India, where we see that the brand has taken a clear position, we will go for a more localized activation and digital campaign. This is for Carrera. Polaroid has a different position. I think Polaroid will go back to be a little bit more a simple proposition. I think what has happened in the year that Polaroid, if you look to the collection, they've been trying to send too many messages, which I think have been a little bit confusing the consumer. So Polaroid is going to be for the simple, affordable, quality product that you like to dress every day. That is going to be the position, and is going to be twisting more toward the millennials, because I think if you look to some of the brands which are successful today, are brands which are lean and are clean, are very easy in terms of messages. So that is going to be the position of Polaroid. But also in this case, for example, Polaroid Turkey, this year we have done an attempt to push Polaroid with local Turkish influencer, again, big success. So these brands, both Polaroid and Carrera, will have a common DNA that we will define globally, but they will have more local executions, mainly in terms of digital activation and local activation. If we look to Smith, Smith is a different story. Smith, I think, has this strong heritage to be what is called sort of tribe brand, because or you love or you hate Smith. You know, you need to be part of the tribe. You need to be part of this adventure, the sport. So Smith has a very, very strong position in sport, snow, North America. He's absolutely the leader in the goggle, in the helmet there. I think what we need to do, starting from North America, because I think that the other market, it will take more time. So starting from North America, we need to move this heritage of sport, of technology, of being recognized to be the premium end. We need to take this approach into the eyewear. Just give you an example. Smith has this specific lens, which is Chromapop, which, by the way, is our patent. We just use for the snow goggle end. We don't use in the eyewear. Why that? I don't get the point. So we know. So we need to take what is specific for the goggle and the high-end sport into the eyewear. But starting from the priority of the geography is going to be North America. In Europe, we will focus on few executions, but more in the sport, because the brand doesn't have the maturity to get in eyewear in Europe. So Europe is going to be snow. North America is going to be get Smith into eyewear. And again, due to the fact that Smith is really a sort of tribe brand, we see that the e-commerce, that we are going to put more people, we have decided to reinforce the people on the e-commerce Smith. The e-commerce is going to be one important leg of the growth of Smith.
I think the other thing, if I would build also a little bit, what is different versus the past, because we've been talking about Encore brands for a while. I think looking at the previous strategic plan, we had ambitions to grow these brands by double, by triple. And I don't think that per se that ambition is wrong, because the brands may have, the potential to be that. But the consequence, I think, of trying to grow that fast in that short amount of time really requires a global play. I mean, you don't get there if you increase tenfold Carrera in one country. So I think what happened as a consequence is that we invested clearly the amount of budget that we have to spend in a very wide amount of geographies. So the individual impact in every country wasn't strong enough. What we're doing now, as Angelo was explaining, we're going to be much more focused. We're going to say, okay, this is a priority brand for the company. These are the five key markets, and here we're going to prioritize our execution, our investments, and really try to win country by country and then gradually build the business. Therefore, the growth assumptions is more moderate, but it doesn't mean that we don't believe in our brands, clearly. Barbara told me there was a question on the web. Maybe you tell me
yes,
the question.
Yes, it's the business development in July.
Yeah, I think in July so far, based on the preliminary statistical things that we see, I think the trend is more or less consistent with what we saw in May and June. It's important to say that July is traditionally the lowest month in the year, so it's not predictive of anything, and it's clearly July and August are months that are between collections. So we have, you know, the spring summer collection sold in, we have the fall winter collection coming from September, October. So the sun is shining, so the consumption on the sunglasses should be better, but I expect that probably we will see the stabilization that we are aiming for, and also the growth in the top line starting rather from the fourth quarter, also considering that, you know, our Q4 of last year was pretty difficult.
Okay.
I have Arturo Lopez, Clearville Advisors. Just two questions. Could you remind us, under the current agreement, what will be the last collection you will be producing for Dior? That's the first one. And the second one is more related to the working capital reduction that you mentioned earlier, about 50 days. Can you please elaborate a little bit more on how do you are planning to achieve that?
Okay. I think on the first question, the Dior license ends at the end of December of 2020, so the last collection would be the fall-winter collection in the year 2020. In terms of the reduction of inventory, I think there are the drivers that basically Angelo explained. I think one important driver is a reduction of lead time. Today we have actually surprisingly long lead times in an industry which is relatively fast moving, so you have to plan quite far in advance and make bets quite far in advance as to what will be the right color, the right model, the right style or whatever. We are working very aggressively to shorten lead time so that we can respond faster. We're working on making our supply chain more reliable, and we're making good progress here. And we are working on the side of forecast accuracy, where today our forecast accuracy on an SKU level is relatively low, and we are quite behind the benchmark of the industry. So with better processes and better systems as well that we have, we believe we can improve, while also reducing the number of SKUs that we have in the portfolio, which is quite a significant number of SKUs, and we'll be much more focused on what are the top and key SKUs in each country.
Giada.
Could you provide with an example of your expansion in the optical business, please?
Yeah. First of all, let's start from the market. I think that, as I said, there are some countries. I mean, as you said, that our share in the optical market is very low compared to the market. But especially in some geographies, if you talk North America, we were Safilo was a sort of leader in the optical market in U.S. So we have somehow weakened our position. How we will go back there through some local American brands and with Safilo, which is going to play on the different price position compared to today. So it's going to be a combination of specific American brands which we have in our portfolio plus Safilo, but Safilo, which is going to be today, Safilo is stretched a little bit more on the upper part. We are going to stretch Safilo on the lower part of the market. So it's going to be a combination of American brands and Safilo with some specific execution, which is going to play in the more mass cool part of the market. This is for North America. For Europe, clearly there are countries like Nordic, Germany, and UK, where there is a big optical market with specialized competitors. clearly our aim is not to go side to side to them, but again, we are going to develop for the second half of the 2019 specific collection which are going to tackle an optical need for, let me say, North European country. These are the two main legs for North America and Europe.
Okay, so as there are no more questions, this ends our presentation, and of course we thank everyone also from the webcast and the conference call also for the patience regarding the bad connection. Sorry for that. Bye.